On the weekend panel are Sam Stubbs, Managing Director of Simplicity KiwiSaver, and he joins me in the Auckland studio. Kia ora, good morning.
Morena.
And we've also got, where are we going to now? We're going to Christchurch, and Ali is a former City Councillor and current Community Board Member for the Papa Nui and Innes wards, and she's on the line from Christchurch. Good morning, Ali.
Morena, how are you?
Let's start with a highlight or a low light from the week. Ali, you first.
Well, I have to say, waking up this morning and sitting in my living room with the fire going and it being minus something outside, I'm really upset to know that a family I've been helping for more than 2 years now, they've got two profoundly autistic young people at home. They're living in two properties on one site in Christchurch. They're still in a broken, earthquake-damaged house. And that's from the September 2010 earthquake, right? So we're talking 11 years. They are still not in a repaired or rebuilt house. And IAG is the insurer. The reports are all done. They were done almost 2 years ago, and now the insurer wants to go back into the house to have a look at it. And I'm sorry, but what most insurers do is then try and start to remove things from, you know, what has been assessed already as earthquake damage. So we can't get an engineer in there, or they can't get their engineers in there until mid-August because we're so short of engineers down here at the moment. And I just think that's unacceptable. So that's the low light. It's been the low light for quite some time as I think about this poor family living in, you know, broken, mold infested, one house hasn't got a shower type properties for 11 years, and I think that's not on.
And do you want to go with a highlight, or should we?
The highlight is actually there's a flip side to that, talking about the cold, frosty Christchurch days at the moment. Wow, I love this time of the year. So it's cold and frosty overnight, and then you wake up in the morning, and it's blue, blue sky, and it's crisp, and the sun's out, and it is just my favourite time of the year. So what's marvellous for me and others, I guess, who like this time of the year, is perhaps a little bit miserable for the family I just described.
Yes. It's Ali Jones, Red PR in Christchurch, and my guest in Auckland, Sam Stubbs.
Yeah.
You want to start with a highlight or a low
light?
Yeah,
sure. So, look, it was last night, actually. We went down to the theatre, and we got on the ferry. We walked through the Viaduct Basin, and I just thought, wow, Auckland's becoming a really big city now. It's developed and big and vibrant and lively. And I was thinking, you know, I've been living here my whole life. And the places I was walking around last night, I mean, they were dumps when I was a kid, right? And they're all developed. So that was the highlight. And I just thought it was cool. And going into the theatre, which was beautiful, the ASB Theatre there, and watching a really cool production. And I just thought, wow, we're lucky, you know, really lucky. The low light was, look, I ran into a family this week who have had to live in 8 houses in 9 years, and their kids have had to go to 8 different schools in 9 years. And I just thought, what a start in life that, what a horrible start in life that is, having to flip schools so much. So comes back to what Ali was saying about housing. You know, it's the human right. It's the ultimate fence at the top of the cliff if you want to have a society where, you know, kids have, you know, stable, happy childhoods. Yeah. Mm.
Thank you, Sam. Well, radio producer Sam Casey was fired from his job at sports radio station Sens this week, and it's a couple of weeks before they've even gone to air. I think I'm saying that right, S-E-N-Z. And it's in the wake of the controversy about an opinion piece he wrote about women's rugby. Sam, did Sens do the right thing by axing him immediately?
Look, it's really hard to know, Karen. I mean, here's a really good example of it's not necessarily what you say, it's how you say it, right? So, look, this reporter clearly had an opinion, and the way he said it and the lack of remorse having said it and the way that it got out there was clearly wrong. So does he deserve censure for it? Clearly. Do we live in a society where people should be given a second chance? I think that's fair, and so I have a question mark about why he was axed so quickly, but equally also, if he was half smart, he would have done what people do when they say silly things. He admitted that the way he said it and the way he wrote it was all a bit chaotic. You should be doing a sort of mea culpa on this one. Did he do that? No. He seemed to dig his toes in and say, stuff you, I really believed it. That's the consequence, you know. So it's not what he said. Everyone should be entitled to have their opinion on these things, even though I think it's a crazy opinion he has. But how he said it and how he didn't effectively go through any public act of remorse when he's a reporter, you know, this is his job. His job is to report things, not to necessarily spout opinions.
Ali, should he have been remorseful? There's some argument that the reaction to his column is symptomatic of the so-called cancel culture that we live in. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I don't think he should have been axed straight away. I do agree with what Sam is saying. I think second chances, though, do depend on what someone has done. There've got to be degrees and reasonableness in coming to that decision. But, you know, I hate this cancel culture. You've got to engage with an idea, I think, rather than an assumed belief system. And if you do that, you might find you're not as opposed as you think you are. We've got to discuss this stuff. It's wrong to have people perhaps too scared or worried about presenting a position that's not necessarily aligned with what the popular or widely accepted view is. You know, if we do that, if we don't allow people to have other views, we're going to end up living in a bubble inflated by wider society's confirmational bias. And we're not going to have intelligent conversations to tease things out. You know, I think we've forgotten how to disagree, actually. We've got to be able to. So one example, I was talking to someone about this during the week, right? You should be able to say, for example, that you believe in Black Lives Matter and you believe that all lives matter. But I know people who have said that and have been absolutely slammed for it. So I think we've got to be able to give people the encouragement and support to raise issues and discuss them in a safe way without being cancelled.
Sam?
Yeah, look, I think that social media is a real problem here, isn't it? Because back in the old days, if you had an opinion, a poorly formed opinion or a racist or sexist opinion, it was pretty hard to get that out beyond your immediate group. Now you can go on social media and suddenly you're transmitting this view to thousands and sometimes hundreds of thousands of people all at once. And people are getting used to the fact that they're actually, they almost think that it's a right to have these views and to transmit these views. And of course, that then ends up having, you sort of end up in this cancel culture, right? Because people are saying, you've offended me, ipso facto, you should not be allowed to communicate with me or, you know, at all. So I think it's a sort of we've ended up in this crazy place now where in a society where we're supposed to have, you know, debate and thought and interaction and so on, and it's never been easier, we end up going off into these sort of mini cultures. What's the phrase for it? Where you get into the social media group where you're only hearing the views and only spouting the views of your own group, because as soon as anyone comes out, you expel them, right? You cancel them out.
So how do we manage that, Sam, right? So what you're saying is absolutely right. So you can't have people going out there and repeating hate speech and racism and sexism and what have you. So where is that line, and how do you allow people to still have those intelligent debates and conversations but not enable that really extreme stuff that you're talking about?
Well, it's really difficult, isn't it? Because at one extreme end, you have sort of like 1984 thought police running around there telling you what you should think and say and do, right? We don't want to be living in that society. On the other hand, we love free speech and free expression. So if people feel like cancelling someone, in theory, they should be allowed to do that and espouse that. So I think ultimately there is no solution. There's nothing that you can impose on it. But what you do is you make sure that you have your kids as educated as possible to understand that, you know what, there are different people with different opinions in these things, and there is a degree of reasonableness about how you say something in a public forum.
And also with the impending hate speech laws, that you're fully versed on what they are and what the difference between offence and hate speech actually is.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, totally. This is all ultimately about education. Most of these views that are espoused in the way are from people who, quite frankly, really haven't thought about it, and they probably haven't been taught about it either.
Not that we know what hate speech is actually, what that qualification is. Let's go to fair play agreements. And National is claiming that Labor are putting workplace democracy at risk with their fair pay agreements, the FPAs, and moving a step towards compulsory unionism. Are the FPAs, as David Seymour concludes, anti-democratic and anti-freedom? Ellie?
Well, what I found interesting in this, Karen, was actually the criticism that the government hadn't taken, you know, the advice of their experts and staff on this. And I think Grant Robertson came back and said, look, it's not that we haven't taken advice. We've listened to what everyone said and we've made a decision on balance. And I think that's really important. You know, having been in local government, which isn't exactly the same as central government, but you still get advice from staff and from, you know, policy people on what you should do. But then you have to consider other stuff as well. So the advice you get could be based just on the law. And you've got to look at what your constituents are saying to you as well. So I think that I don't know enough about it. What worries me is that contractors aren't going to be a part of this, and that could be providing some advantage to people who are not contractors. I think it needs to be, again, it needs to be talked about a bit more, and I haven't seen the conversation much.
Sam?
Karen, I've been around long enough now to know that this is all politics, right? So you get left-leaning governments, and the unions feel as if they'll have power and influence. They start to exercise it. They fundamentally want to have compulsory unionism in a whole lot of areas, but in many ways they're kind of out of touch with the way the modern workforce goes, because you do have so many more contractors who don't want to be compulsorily enrolled in anyone. And then you get swings back to the right and you get union powers taken away. I think what's really important here is that I think this is somewhat of a red herring, because the most important thing about this is having as high as possible minimum wages, and then you have living wages, which is what we do as well, which means you pay people even more more than that. It's what people get paid that gets mandated here. I think that the unions would like to turn this into a political, giving them more strength and influence as a consequence of having semi-compulsory or compulsory membership. At the end of the day, I don't think that's going to work. I think Ali's right. What this will do is this, if this comes in, this will actually encourage employers to hire more contractors. And then the government and the unions have to think about, well, how do we get contractors in? Well, you can't do that. You're running your own business. You can't be forced to join any organisation if you don't want to. So I don't think this is going to be particularly successful in achieving what the unions wish to achieve. The much more important thing is having higher minimum wages and living wages, which is campaigns they've been on, which have been very successful and entirely right.
My guests on the weekend panel this morning are Sam Stubbs, the Managing Director of Simplicity KiwiSaver, and Ellie Jones from Red PR in Christchurch. And meanwhile, David Seymour has edged ahead of Judith Collins as preferred Prime Minister in the new UMR poll, although Jacinda Ardern is ahead of both by miles. Who would you want to be in charge if it came down to Seymour versus Collins?
Ali, would you like me to dive in here?
Yeah, I think you should Sam.
Look, I'm what my communist friend of mine calls a filthy centrist, right? I'm right in the middle. So I look at the advocates of the right and the left, and look, I've had interactions with both and seen them both operate. I think the more effective politician right now is David Seymour, and I think the ideas he's getting out there, because they're more the ideas of the, let's call it the further right rather than the centre right, are a little bit clearer. You can espouse them a little bit more vociferously there. But I do think that David Seymour is a very effective communicator. I think he's doing a really good job. Judith Collins is struggling for sure. So if I had to choose someone, and you force me to choose, because, you know, I'm a filthy centrist, I'd probably say David Seymour would be a more effective leader of the right now. And that's being, you know, it's all coming out in the polls, isn't it? People are being asked, and this is what people think.
You'd have to say he's come a long way, baby.
Wow, has he ever, eh?
Ellie, what do you think?
Oh, look, I really don't know, but I think they've both got very different jobs, Sam. So I think that, you know, you're probably not giving Judith Collins the credit that she deserves and what she has managed to achieve, and even just staying there actually over the last, you know, 12 months to 2 years. I mean, I like David Seymour because I think he's funny, and I mean that seriously. He has a sense of humour, and he does make me laugh when he does say something funny. I think Judith is funny, but perhaps not so intentionally. So, yeah, look, I think there are good things in both. I think there are bad things in both. Boy, that's sitting on the fence.
I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? 5 years is a massively long time in politics. You look back at the previous national government, you would have thought their front bench and their depth of talent would have been unassailable. You would have thought that, you know, they'd have strong leaders all the way through, and it's just been relatively chaotic since then. And, of course, previous to them, of course, you looked at the Labor Party before them and you thought, how could you possibly not have an incredible deep bench of talent? And yet they fell apart under a key government as well. So it's, politics is a fickle game.
Sam, it was like all the men just fell over, wasn't it? Like bowling pins, 10-pin bowling pins. And then you've got Jacinda Ardern in there now, and to her credit, Judith Collins as well, who just basically just keeps standing there, taking the hits. And before her, there was this sort of falling down of a number of male. I could never understand actually why she didn't get the role in the first instance before. God, I've forgotten his name now. See, there you go. Who can remember? Who was the chap just before her?
Simon.
I was thinking of the one before him, actually.
Who stepped down?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Todd Muller, due to
Todd, that's it. See, look, you know who can remember.
Okay, going to wagging school. Did you wag school, either of you, when you were coming through the ranks, Ellie?
No, I was a very good girl. I never did that.
Official figures in May showed more than 60,000 students classified as chronically absent, missing at least 3 days of school every fortnight, and almost 40% of pupils not going to school regularly. Are we too lenient with truancy in New Zealand? Sam?
Look, I think this is a really complex social problem. I think that, you know, this is indicative of a whole bunch of stuff going wrong. You know, we talked about housing insecurity beforehand. I don't think you can point the finger at any one party, but what I would say is that, I mean, have you heard of or have you seen any creative ways of trying to reduce truancy? You know, no. I think that we're having the same arguments we had 20 years ago here, and yet the problem is getting worse and worse and worse. So, I think it's a really good bellwether, actually. You know, you talk about the wellness budget and the government looking at wellness. I think school truancy rates are a really good bellwether of whether or not we've got a whole bunch of stuff right, and clearly that's not the case.
Can you point the finger at anybody or no one to blame? If you're looking at children, they're not to blame. Parents, teachers, schools, government, who? Ellie?
Oh, I think it's, as Sam just said, it's a whole lot of stuff. So I don't think you can point the finger particularly. I mean, there was truancy, you know, 30-odd years ago when I was at school. And actually, I did wag school once. I went to a Lincoln University Stein and had a few too many beers at the age of 16 and nearly got expelled. But that's a whole lifetime ago. But I think that there are, I think the housing issue is a big one. As you said, Sam, people moving, you know, eight times means that they perhaps don't connect to a community or connect to a school. So, yeah, I think it's a whole lot of stuff, but I totally agree. I don't think we should necessarily be looking at the truancy figures. I think we've got to look at the issues that are causing those issues and figures.
I think also, you know, you need to look at incentives, right? So you have a well-funded Department of Education here. There doesn't seem to be a lot of initiatives coming out there to prevent truancy there. One of the things we have a charity, one of the things our charity is looking at is whether or not actually incentivising parents to keep their kids at school might be a thing to look at. This is something that which is done in about 23 different countries around the world. So,
do you mean financially incentivised?
Yeah. So we're just looking at it right now. It's because clearly what we need to do is we need to find some creative ways of handling this problem, right? Because kids not being at school is disastrous. I mean, if you have a look at all the surveys about every year of school that a kid doesn't go to, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars of lifetime earnings, and that money gives people choices and dignity in life, right? So if you want to create a permanent underclass in New Zealand, make sure the kids don't go to school. Here's the really interesting thing about New Zealand. We have amongst the most accurate school attendance records in the world. We're really good at working out whether kids are in school or not on any one day. In fact, most kids get polled twice a day. Many times it's every class, right? We've got incredibly good figures here, but we seem to be not kind of working out how we keep the kids in school.
But aren't you potentially putting a Band-Aid on the problem if you financially incentivise parents to make sure their kids are at school? Yep. If the kids aren't engaged and the reason that they don't want to go to school isn't addressed and is fixed by paying the parents, aren't you creating another problem?
Yeah, possibly you are. And it's a really complex issue. The issue that here is, though, is we have to try some new things, right? Because at the moment, it's the status quo isn't working.
And just briefly, we're coming up to the 9 o'clock news, but a comment on a New Zealand mother reportedly naming her three children Metallica, Slayer and Pantera.
Yeah, well.
What do you reckon?
Well, look, you know, I grew up as a kid in West Auckland, and my parents, God bless them, called me Arthur, and they didn't realise that that was, you know, back in West Auckland where I live, that got you beaten up at school, so we changed my name to Sam. And now Arthur's come back into fashion again, so it's cool to be called Arthur. It's as crazy as that. I mean, look, you know what Elon Musk called his kid? There's this AE12, something like that. Yeah.
Ellie?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think it's stupid. You've got to think of the kids, right? Why the hell would you call a kid spinach or snort, for God's sake? I mean, it makes no sense at all. And you've just got to think about the children. This isn't about the adults or the parents. Think about your children.
Ellie, thank you very much. And thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
Weekend panel this morning.
Thank you.
Sam Stubbs, Managing Director of Simplicity KiwiSaver, and Ellie Jones from Red PR in Christchurch.